Welcome to a continuation of the Discourses upon the Existence and Attributes of God by Stephen Charnock, Volume 2, Part 29. This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, CDs and much more, at great discounts, are on the web at www.swrb.com. Also, please consider, pray and act upon the important truths found in the following quotation by Charles Spurgeon. As the Apostle says to Timothy, so also he says to everyone, give yourself to reading. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read. Renounce as much as you will all like literature, but study as much as possible sound theological works, especially the Puritanic writers and expositions of the Bible. The best way for you to spend your leisure is to be either reading or praying. And now to SWRB's reading of Charnock, which we hope you find to be a great blessing, and which we pray draws you nearer to the Lord Jesus Christ. For he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but by him. John 14, verse 6. Second, his dominion is absolute in regard of unlimitedness by any law without him. He is an absolute monarch that makes laws for his subjects, but is not bound by any himself, nor receives any rules and laws from his subjects for the management of his government. But most governments in the world are bounded by laws made by common consent. But when kings are not limited by the laws of their kingdoms, yet they are bounded by the laws of nature and by the providence of God. But God is under no law without himself. His rule is within him, the rectitude and righteousness of his own nature. He is not under that law he hath prescribed to man. The law was not made for a righteous man, 1 Timothy 1:9, much less for a righteous God. God is his own law. His own nature is his rule, as his own glory is his end. Himself is his end, and himself is his law. He is moved by nothing without himself. Nothing hath the dominion of a motive over him but his own will, which is his rule for all his actions in heaven and earth. Daniel 4, verse 32. He rules in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomsoever he will. And Romans 9, 18. He hath mercy on whom he will have mercy, as all things are wrought by him according to his own eternal ideas in his own mind. So all is wrought by him according to the inward motive in his own will, which was a manifestation of his own honour. The greatest motives, therefore, that the best persons used when they have pleaded for any grant from God was his own glory, which would be advanced by any answer of their petition. Third, his dominion is absolute in regard of supremacy and uncontrollableness. None can implead him and cause him to render a reason for his actions. He is the sovereign king. Who may say unto him, what doest thou? Ecclesiastes 8:4. It is an absurd thing for any to dispute with God. Romans 9:20, 11:20. Who art thou, O man, that repliest against God? Thou, a man, a piece of dust to argue with a God incomprehensibly above thy reason, above the reason of his works. Let the potsherds strive with the potsherds of the earth, but not with him that fashioned them. Isaiah 45, verse 9. In all the desolations he works, he asserts his own supremacy to silence men. Psalm 46, verse 10. Be still and know that I am God. Beware of any quarrelling motions in your minds. It is sufficient that I am God. That is supreme and will not be impleaded and censured or worded with by any creature about what I do. He is not bound to render a reason of any of his proceedings. Subjects are accountable to their princes. and princes to God, God to none. Since he is not limited by any superior, his prerogative is supreme. Fourth, his dominion is absolute in regard of irresistibleness. Other governments are bounded by law, so that what a governor has strength to do, he has not a right to do. Other governors have a limited ability, that what they have a right to do, they have not always a strength to do. They may want a power to execute their own counsels. But God is destitute of neither. He hath an infinite right and an infinite strength. His word is a law. He commands things to stand out of nothing, and they do so. He commanded or spoke, light to shine out of darkness, 2 Corinthians 4:6. There is no distance of time between his word, let there be light, and there was light, Genesis 1:3. Magistrates often use not their authority for fear of giving occasion to insurrections, which may overturn their empire. But if the Lord will work, who shall let it? Isaiah 43, verse 19. And if God will not work, who shall force him? He can check and overturn all other powers. His decrees cannot be stopped, nor his hand held back by any. If he wills to dash the whole world in pieces, no creature can maintain its being against his order. He sets the ordinances of the heavens, and the dominion thereof in the earth, and sends lightnings that they may go, and say unto him, here we are. Job 38, verse 33 and 34. 3. Yet this dominion, though it be absolute, is not tyrannical, but it is managed by the rules of wisdom, righteousness, and goodness. If his throne be in the heavens, it is pure and good, because the heavens are the purest parts of the creation, and influenced by their goodness the lower earth. Since he is his own rule, and his nature is infinitely wise, holy, and righteous, he cannot do a thing but what is unquestionably agreeable with wisdom, justice, and purity. In all the exercises of his sovereign right, he is never unattended with those perfections of his nature. Might not God, by his absolute power, have pardoned men's guilt and thrown the invading sin out of his creatures? But in regard of his truth, pawned in his threatening, and in regard of his justice, which demanded satisfaction, he would not. Might not God, by his absolute sovereignty, admit a man into his friendship, without giving him any grace? But in regard of the incongruity of such an act up to his wisdom and holiness, he will not. May he not, by his absolute power, refuse to accept a man that desires to please him, and reject a purely innocent creature? But in regard of his goodness and righteousness, he will not. Though innocence be amiable in its own nature, yet it is not necessary in regard of God's sovereignty that he should love it. But in regard of his goodness, it is necessary, and he will never do otherwise. As God never acts to the utmost of his power, so he never exerts the utmost of his sovereignty, because it would be inconsistent with those other properties which render him perfectly adorable to the creature. As no intelligent creature, neither angel nor man, can be framed without a law in his nature, so we cannot imagine God without a law in his own nature, unless we would fancy him a rude, tyrannical, foolish being that had nothing of holiness, goodness, righteousness, wisdom. If he made the heavens in wisdom, Psalm 136, verse 5, he made them by some rule, not by mere will, but a rule within himself, not without. A wise work is never the result of an absolute and guided will. 1. This dominion is managed by the rule of wisdom. What may appear to us to have no other spring than absolute sovereignty would be found to have a depth of amazing wisdom and countable wisdom, were our short capacities long enough to fathom it. When the apostle had been discoursing of the eternal counsels of God, in seizing upon one man and letting go another, in neglecting the Jews and gathering in the Gentiles, which appears to us to be the result only of an absolute dominion, yet he resolves not those amazing acts into that, without taking it for granted that they were governed by exact wisdom, though beyond his ken to see and his line to sound. Oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out, Romans 2:33. There are some things in matters of state that may seem to be acts of mere will, but if we were acquainted with them, the inward engines which moved them, and the ends aimed at in those undertakings, we might find a rich vein of prudence in them to incline us to judge otherwise than bare arbitrary proceedings. The other attributes of power and goodness are more easily perceptible in the works of God than his wisdom. The first view of the creation strikes us with this sentiment, that the author of this great fabric was mighty and beneficial. But his wisdom lies deeper than to be discerned at the first glance, without a diligent inquiry. As at the first casting our eyes upon the sea, we behold its motion, colour, and something of its vastness, but we cannot presently fathom the depth of it, and understand those lower fountains that supply that great ocean of waters. It is part of God's sovereignty, as it is of the wisest princes, that he hath a wisdom beyond the reach of his subjects. It is not for a finite nature to understand an infinite wisdom, nor for a foolish creature that have lost his understanding by the fall, to judge of the reason and the methods of a wise counsellor. Yet those actions that say the most of sovereignty present men with some glances of his wisdom. Was it mere will that he suffered some angels to fall? But his wisdom was in it, for the manifestation of his justice, as it was also in the case of Pharaoh. Was it mere will that he suffered sin to be committed by man? Was not his wisdom in this for the discovery of his mercy, which never had been known without that, which should render a creature miserable? He hath concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. Romans 11:32. Though God had such an absolute right to have annihilated the world as soon as ever he had made it, yet how had this consisted with his wisdom to erect the creature after his own image one day and despise it so much the next as to cashier it from being? What wisdom had it been to make a thing only to destroy it, to repent of his work as soon as ever it came out of his hands, without any occasion offered by the creature? If God be supposed to be creator, he must be supposed to have an end in creation. What can that be but himself and his own glory, the manifestation of the perfections of his nature? What perfection could have been discovered in so quick an annihilation but that of his power in creating and of his sovereignty in snatching away the being of his rational creature, before it had laid the methods of acting? What wisdom to make a world and a reasonable creature for no use, not to praise and honour him, but to be broken in pieces and destroyed by him? 2. His sovereignty is managed according to the rule of righteousness. Worldly princes often fancy tyranny and oppression to be the chief marks of sovereignty, and think their sceptres not beautiful till dyed in blood, nor the throne secure till established upon slain carcasses. But justice and judgment are the foundation of the throne of God. Psalm 89:14, alluding perhaps to the supporters of arms and thrones, which among princes are the figures of lions, emblems of courage, as Solomon had, 1 Kings 10:19. But God makes not so much might as right the support of his. He sits on a throne of holiness, Psalm 47:8. As he reigns over the heathens, referring to the calling of the Gentiles after the rejection of the Jews, the psalmist here praising the righteousness of it, as the apostle had the unsearchable wisdom of it, Romans 9:33. In all his ways he is righteous, Psalm 145:17. In his ways of terror, as well as those of sweetness, in those works wherein little else but that of his sovereignty appears to us. It is always linked with his holiness, that he will not do, by his absolute right, anything but what is conformable to it. Since his dominion is founded upon the excellency of his nature, he will not do anything but what is agreeable to it, and becoming his other perfections. Though he be an absolute sovereign, he is not an arbitrary governor. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Genesis 18:25. It is impossible that he should act righteously in every punctilio of his government, since his righteousness capacitates him to be a judge, not a tyrant of all the earth. The heathen poets represented their chief god Jupiter with Themis, or Right, sitting by him upon his throne in all his orders. God cannot, by his absolute sovereignty, command some things, because they are directly against unchangeable righteousness, as to command a creature to hate or blaspheme the Creator, not to own him nor praise him. It would be a manifest unrighteousness to order the creature not to own him, upon whom he depends both in its being and well-being. This would be against the natural duty which is indispensably due from every rational creature to God. This would be to order him to lay aside his reason while he retains it, to disown him to be the Creator while man remains his creature. This is repugnant to the nature of God and the true nature of the creature, or to exact anything of man but what he had given him a capacity in his original nature to perform. If any command were above our natural power, it would be unrighteous, as to command a man to grasp the globe of the earth, to stride over the sea, to lave out the waters of the ocean. These things are impossible, and become not the righteousness and wisdom of God to enjoin. There can be no obligation on man to an impossibility. God had a free dominion over nullity before the creation. He could call it out into the being of man and beast, but he could not do anything in creation foolishly, because of his infinite wisdom. Nor could he, by the right of his absolute sovereignty, make man sinful, because of his infinite purity. As it is impossible for him not to be sovereign, it is impossible for him to deny his deity and his purity. It is lawful for God to do what he will, but his will being ordered by the righteousness of his nature, as infinite as his will, he cannot do anything but what is just. And therefore, in his dealing with men, you find find him in Scripture submitting the reasonableness and equity of his proceedings to the judgment of his depraved creatures and the inward dictates of their own conscience. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem, the men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. Isaiah 5, verse 3. Though God be the great sovereign of the world, yet he acts not in a way of absolute sovereignty. He rules by law. He is a lawgiver, as well as a king, Isaiah 33, 22. It had been repugnant to the nature of a rational creature to be ruled otherwise, to be governed as a beast. This had been to frustrate those faculties of will and understanding which had been given him. To conclude this, when we say God can do this or that, or command this or that, his authority is not bounded and limited properly. Who can reasonably detract from his almightiness? Because he cannot do anything which savours of weakness. And what detracting is it from his authority that he cannot do anything unseemly for the dignity of his nature? It is rather from the infiniteness of his righteousness than the straightness of his authority. At most, it is but a voluntary bounding his dominion by the law of his own holiness. 3. His sovereignty is managed according to the rule of goodness. Some potentates there have been in the world that have loved to suck the blood and drink the tears of their subjects, that would rule more by fear than love, like Cleocus, the tyrant of Heraclea, who bore the figure of a thunderbolt instead of a scepter, and named his son Thunder, thereby to tutor him to terrify his subjects. But as God's throne is a throne of holiness, so it is a throne of grace, Hebrews 4, verse 16, a throne encircled with a rainbow, in sight like to an emerald, Revelation 4, 23, an emblem of the covenant that hath the pleasantness of a green colour, delightful to the eye, betokening mercy. Though his nature be infinitely excellent above us, and his power infinitely transcendent over us, yet the majesty of his government is tempered with an unspeakable goodness. He acts not so much as an absolute lord, as a gracious sovereign, an obliging benefactor. He delights not to make his subjects slaves, exact not from them any servile and fearful, but a generous and cheerful obedience. He requires them not to fear or worship him so much for his power as his goodness. He requires not of a rational creature anything repugnant to the honour, dignity, and principles of such a nature, nor anything that may shame, disgrace it, and make it weary of its own being, and the service it owes to its sovereign. He draws by the cords of a man. His goodness renders his laws as sweet as honey or the honeycomb to an unvitiated palate and a renewed mind. And though it be granted, he hath a bull disposed of his creature as a potter of his vessel, and might by his absolute sovereignty inflict upon an innocent and eternal torment. Yet his goodness will never fail limit him to use this sovereign right to the hurt of a creature that deserves it not. If God should cast an innocent creature into the furnace of his wrath, who can question him? Who can think that his goodness will do so, since that is as infinite as his authority? As not to punish the sinner would be a denial of his justice, so to torment an innocent would be a denial of his goodness. A man hath an absolute power over his beast, and may take away his life, and put him to a great deal of pain. But that moral virtue of pity and tenderness would not permit him to use this right, but when it conduces to some greater good then that can be evil, either for the good of man, which is the end of the creature, or for the good of the poor beast itself, to render him of a greater misery. None but a savage nature, a disposition to be absorbed, would torture a poor beast merely for his pleasure. It is as much against the nature of God to punish one eternally that has not deserved it, as it is to deny himself and act anything foolishly and unbeseeming his other perfections, which render him majestical and adorable. To afflict an innocent creature for his own good, or for the good of the world, as in the case of the Redeemer, is so far from being against goodness, that it is the highest testimony of his tender bowels to the sons of men. God, though he be mighty, withdraws not his eyes, i.e. his tender respect, from the righteous. Job 36, verse 5:7-10. And if he bind them in fetters, it is to show them their transgressions, and open their ear to discipline, and renewing commands in a more sensible strain, to be apart from iniquity. What was said of Fabritius, you may as soon remove the sun from his course as Fabritius from his honesty, may be of God. You may as soon dash in pieces his throne as separate his goodness from his sovereignty. For this sovereignty is extensive over all creatures. He rules all as the heavens do over the earth. He is king of worlds, king of ages, as the word translated eternal signifies, 1 Timothy 1:17. And the same word is so translated, Hebrews 1:2, by whom also he made the worlds. The same word is rendered worlds, Hebrews 11:3. The worlds were framed by the word of God. God is king of ages, or worlds, of the invisible world and the sensible, of all from the beginning of their creation, of whatsoever is measured by a time. It extends over angels and devils, over wicked and good, over rational and irrational creatures. All things bow down under his hand. Nothing can be exempted from him, because there is nothing but was extracted by him from nothing into being. All things essentially depend upon him, and therefore must be essentially subject to him. The extent of his dominion flows from the perfection of his essence. Since his essence is unlimited, his royalty cannot be restrained. His authority is as void of any imperfection as his essence is. It reaches out to all points of the heaven above and the earth below. Other princes reign in a spot of ground. Every worldly potentate hath the confines of his dominions. The Pyrenean mountains divide France from Spain, and the Alps, Italy from France. None are called kings absolutely, but kings of this or that place. But God is the king. The spacious firmament limits not his dominion. If we could suppose him bounded by any place in regard of his presence, yet he could never be out of his own dominion. Whatsoever he looks upon, wheresoever he were, would be under his rule. Earthly kings may step out of their own country into the territory of a neighbor prince. And as one leaves his country, so he leaves his dominion behind him. But heaven and earth, and every particle of both, is the territory of God. He hath prepared his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom rules over all. 1. The heaven of angels and other excellent creatures belong to his authority. He is principally called the Lord of hosts, in relation to his entire command over the angelic legions. Therefore, verse 21, following the text, they are called his hosts and ministers that do his pleasure. Jacob called him so before, Genesis 32, verse 1 and 2. When he met the angels of God, he calls them the hosts of God. And the evangelist, long after, calls them so, Luke 2:13, a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God. And all this host he commands, Isaiah 45, verse 12. My hands have stretched out the heavens, and all their hosts have I commanded. He employs them all in his service, and when he issues out his orders to them to do this or that, he finds no resistance of his will. And the inanimate creatures in heaven are at his beck. They are his armies in heaven, disposed in an excellent order in their several ranks. Psalm 147, verse 4. He calls the stars by name. They render a due obedience to him as servants to their master when he singles them out and calls them by name to do some special service. He calls them out to their several offices as the general of an army appoints the station of every regiment in a battalion. Or he calls them by name, i.e. he imposes names upon them, a sign of dominion. The giving names to the inferior creatures in the first act of Adam's derivative dominion over them. These are under the sovereignty of God. The stars by their influences fight against Sisera, Judges 5:20, and the sun holds in its reins and stand stone still to light Joshua to a complete victory, Joshua 10:12. They are all marshalled in their ranks to receive his word or command, and fight in close order, as being desirous to have a share in the ruin and enemies of the enemies of their sovereign. And those creatures which mount up from the earth and take their place in the lower heavens, vapors, whereof hail and snow are formed, are part of the army, and do not only receive, but fulfill his word of command. Psalm 148, verse 8. These are his stores and magazines of judgment against a time of trouble and a day of battle and war. Job 38, verse 22-23. The sovereignty of God is visible in all their motions, in their going and returning. If he says go, they go. If he say come, they come. If he say do this, they gird up their loins and stand stiff to their duty. Two, the hell of devils belong to his authority. They have cast themselves out of the arms of his grace into the furnace of his justice. They have, by their revolt, forfeited the treasure of his goodness, but cannot exempt themselves from the scepter of his dominion. When they would not own him as a Lord Father, they are under him as a Lord Judge. They are cast out of his affection, but not freed from his yoke. He rules over the good angels as his subjects, over the evil ones as his rebels. In whatsoever relation he stands, either as friend or enemy, he never loses that of a lord. A prince is the lord of his criminals as well as his loyalist subjects. By this right of his sovereignty, he uses them to punish some and be the occasion of benefit to others. On the wicked, he employs them as instruments of vengeance, towards the godly, as in the case of Job, as an instrument of kindness, for the manifestation of his sincerity against the intention of their malicious executioner. Though the devils are the executioners of his justice, it is not by their own authority but God's, as those that are employed either to rack or execute a malefactor are subjects to the prince, not only in the quality of men, but in the execution of their function. The devil, by drawing men to sin, acquires no right to himself over the sinner, for man by sin offends not the devil, but God, and becomes guilty of punishment under God. When therefore the devil is used by God for the punishment of any, it is an act of his sovereignty for the manifestation of the order of his justice. And as most nations use the vilest persons in offices of execution, so doth God those vile spirits. He doth not ordinarily use the good angels in those offices of vengeance, but in the preservation of his people. When he would solely punish, he employs evil angels. Psalm 78, verse 49, a troop of devils. His sovereignty is extended over the deceiver and the deceived, Job 12:16, over both the malefactor and the executioner, the devil and his prisoner. He useth the natural malice of the devils for his own just ends, and by his own sovereign authority orders them to be the executioners of his judgments upon their own vassals, as well as sometimes inflictors of punishments upon his own servants. 3. The earth of men and other creatures belongs to his authority. Psalm 47, verse 7. God is king of all the earth and rules to the ends of it. Psalm 59, verse 13. Ancient atheists confined God's dominion to the heavenly orbs and bounded it within the circuit of the celestial sphere. Job 22, verse 14. He walks in the circuit of heaven, i.e. exercises his dominion only there. It was a sign of the possession of a piece of land, and the dominion of the possessor of it. The land was resigned by such a ceremony as now by the delivery of a twig or turf, but his dominion extends. First, over the least creatures. All the creatures of the earth are listed in Christ's muster roll, and make up the number of his regiments. He hath an host on earth as well as in heaven, Genesis 2:1. The heavens and the earth were finished, and all the hosts of them, and they are all his servants, Psalm 114, verse 91, and move at his pleasure. And he vouchsafes the title of his army to the locust, caterpillar, and palmer worm, Joel 2:25, and describes their motions by military words, climbing the walls, marching, not breaking their ranks, verse 7. He hath the command, as a great general, over the highest angel and the meanest worm. All the kinds of the smallest insects he presses for his service. By this sovereignty he muzzled the devouring nature of the fire to reserve the three children, and let it loose to consume their adversaries. And if he speaks the word, the stormy winds waves up are hushed, as if they had no principle of rage within them. Psalm 89, verse 9. Since the meanest creature attains his end, and no arrow that God hath by his power shot into the world, but hits the mark he aimed at, we must conclude that there is a sovereign hand that governs all. Not a spot of earth, or air, or water in the world, but is his possession. Not a creature in any element, but is his subject. Second, His dominion extends over men. It extends over the highest potentate, as well as the meanest peasant. The proudest monarch is no more exempt than the most languishing beggar. He lays not aside his authority to please the prince, nor strains it up to terrify the indigent. He accepts not the persons of princes, nor regards the rich more than the poor, for they are all the work of his hand, Job 34:19. Both the powers and weaknesses, the gallantry and peasantry of the earth, stand and fall at his pleasure. Man in innocence was under his authority as his creature, and man in his revolt is further under his authority as a criminal, as a person is under the authority of a prince, as a governor while he obeys his laws, and further under the authority of the prince, as a judge when he violates his laws. Man is under God's dominion in everything, in his settlement, in his calling, in the ordering his very habitation. Acts 17:26. He determines the bounds of their habitations. He never yet permitted any to be universal monarch in the world, nor over the fourth part of it, though several, in the pride of their heart, have designed and attempted it. The Pope, who hath bid the fairest for it in spirituals, never attained it, and when his power was most flourishing, there were multitudes that would never acknowledge his authority. Third, but especially this dominion, in the peculiarity of its extent, is seen in the exercise of it over the spirits and hearts of men. Earthly governors have, by his indulgence, a share with him in a dominion over men's bodies, upon which account he graces princes and judges with the title of gods. Psalm 82:6. But the highest prince is but a prince, according to the flesh, as the apostle calls masters in relation to their servants. Colossians 3:22. God is the sovereign. Man rules over the beast. Man rules over the beast in man, the body, and God rules over the man in man, the soul. It sticks not in the outward surface, but pierces to the inward marrow. It is impossible God should be without this. If our wills were independent of him, we were in some sort equal with himself, in part gods, as well as creatures. It is impossible a creature, either in whole or in part, can be exempted from it, since he is a passioner of hearts as well as bodies. He is the father of spirits, and therefore hath the right of a paternal dominion over them. When he established man lord of the other creatures, he did not strip himself of the propriety. And when he made man a free agent, the lord of the acts of his will, he did not divest himself of the sovereignty. His sovereignty is seen, 1, in gifting the spirits of men. Earthly magistrates have hands too short to inspire the hearts of their subjects with worthy sentiments. When they confer an employment, they are not able to convey an ability with it fit for the station. They may as soon frame a statue of liquid water and gild, or paint it over with the costliest colours, as impart to any a state head for a state ministry. But when God chooseth a soul from so mean an employment as seeking of asses, he can treasure up in him a spirit fit for government, and fire David, in age a stripling, and by education a shepherd, with courage to encounter, and skill to defeat, a massy Goliath. And when he designs a person for glory, stand before his throne, he can put a new and royal spirit into him. Ezekiel 36:26. God can infuse habits into the soul to capacitate it to act nobly and generously. 2. His sovereignty is seen in regard of the inclinations of men's wills. No creature can immediately work upon the will to guide it to what point he pleases, though immediately it may, by proposing reasons which may master the understanding, and thereby determine the will. But God bows the hearts of men, by the efficacy of his dominion, to what centre he pleaseth. When the more overweening sort of men, that thought their own heads as fit for a crown of souls, scornfully despise him, yet God touched the hearts of a band of men to follow and adhere to him. 1 Samuel 10:26-27. When the anti-Christian whore shall be ripe for destruction, God shall put it into the heart of the 10 horns or kings to hate the whore, burn her with fire, and fulfill his will. Revelation 17:16-17. He fashions the hearts alike, and tunes one string to answer another, and both to answer his own design. Psalm 33:15. And while men seem to gratify their own ambition and malice, they execute the will of God by his secret touch upon their spirits, guiding their inclinations to serve the glorious manifestation of truth. While the Jews would, in a reproachful disgrace to Christ, crucify 2 thieves with him to render him more incapable to have any followers, they accomplished a prophecy and brought to light a mark of the Messiah, whereby he had been characterized in one of their prophets, that he should be numbered among transgressors. Isaiah 53:12. It can make a man of not willing, willing. The wills of all men are in his hand, i.e. under the power of his scepter, to retain or let go upon this or that errand, then this or that way, as water is carried by pipes to what house or place the owner of it is pleased to order. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, as the rivers of waters. He turns it where, whithersoever he will. Proverbs 21:1, without any limitation. He speaks of the heart of princes, because in regard of their height, they seem to be more absolute and impetuous as waters. Yet God holds them in his hand, under his dominion, turns them to acts of clemency or severity like waters, either to overflow and damage, or to refresh and fructify. He can convey a spirit to them, or cut it off from them. Psalm 76:12. It is with reference to his efficacious power in graciously turning the heart of Paul that the Apostle Paul breaks off his discourse of the story of his conversion and breaks out into a magnifying and glorifying of God's dominion. Now unto the King eternal, etc., be honor and glory for ever and ever. 1 Timothy 1:17. Our hearts are more subject to the divine sovereignty than our members in their motions are subject to our own wills. As we can move our hand east or west to any quarter of the world, so can God bend our wills to what mark he pleases. The second cause in every motion depends upon the first. And that will, being a second cause, may be furthered or hindered in its inclinations or executions by God. He can bend or unbend it, and change it from one actual inclination to another. It is as much under his authority and power to move or hinder, as the vast engine of the heavens is in its motions or standing still. which he can effect by a word. The work depends upon the workman, the clock, upon the artificer, for the emotions of it. 3. His dominion is seen in regard of terror or comfort. The heart or conscience is God's special throne on earth, which he hath reserved to himself, and never indulged human authority to sit upon it. He solely orders this in ways of conviction or comfort. He can flash terror into men's spirits in the midst of their earthly jollities, and put death into the pot of conscience when they are boiling up themselves in a high pitch of worldly delights, and can raise men's spirits above the sense of torment under racks and flames. He can draw a handwriting, not only in the outward chamber, but the inward closet, bring the rack into the inwards of a man. None can infuse comfort when he writes better things, nor can any fill the heart with gall when he drops in honey. Men may order outward duties, but they cannot unlock the conscience and constrain men to think them duties which they are forced by human laws outwardly to act. And as the laws of earthly princes are bounded by the outward man, so do their executions and punishments reach no further than the case of the body. But God can run upon the inward man as a giant, and inflict wounds and gashes there. 5. It is an eternal dominion. In regard of the exercise of it, it was not from eternity, because there was not from eternity any creature under the government of it. But in regard of the foundation of it, his essence, his excellency, it is eternal, as God from eternity almighty, but there was no exercise or manifestation of it till he began to create. Men are kings only for a time. Their lives expire like a lamp, and their dominion is extinguished with their lives. They hand their empire by succession to others, but many times it is snapped off before they are cold in their grave. How are the famous empires of the Chaldeans, Medes, Persians, and Greeks moulded away, and their place knows them no more? And how are the wings of the Roman eagle cut, and that empire which overspread a great part of the world has lost most of its feathers and is confined to a narrow compass? The dominion of God flourishes from one generation to another. He sits King forever. Psalm 29:10. His session signifies the establishment, and forever the duration. And he sits now. His sovereignty is as absolute, as powerful as ever. How many lords and princes have this or that kingdom had? In how many families hath the scepter lodged, when as God hath had an uninterrupted dominion, as he hath been always the same in his essence, he hath always glorious, he has been always glorious in his sovereignty among men. He that is Lord today may be stripped of it tomorrow. The dominions in the world vary. He that is a prince may see his royalty upon the wings, and feel himself laden with fetters, and a prisoner may be lifted from his dungeon to a throne. But there can be no diminution of God's government. His throne is from generation to generation. Lamentations 5:9. It cannot be shaken. His scepter, like Aaron's rod, is always green. It cannot be wrested out of his hands. None raised him to it. None therefore can dispose him from it. It bears the same splendor in all human affairs. He is an eternal and immortal king. 1 Timothy 1:17. As he is eternally mighty, so he is eternally sovereign. And being an eternal king, he is king that gives not a momentary and perishing, but a durable and everlasting life to them that obey him, a durable and eternal punishment to them that resist him. 4. Wherein this dominion and sovereign consists, and how it is manifested. First, the first act of sovereignty is the making laws. This is essential to God. No creature's will can be the first rule to the creature, but only the will of God. He only can prescribe a man his duty and establish the rule of it. Hence the law is called the royal law, James 2:8, it being the first and clearest manifestation of sovereignty, as the power of legislation is of the authority of a prince. Both are joined together in Isaiah 53:22. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. Legislative power being the great mark of royalty. God as king enacts his laws by his own proper authority, and his law is a declaration of his sovereignty and of men's moral subjection to him and dependence on him. His sovereignty does not appear so much in his promises as is in his precepts. A man's power over another is not discovered by promising, for a promise does not suppose a promiser either superior or inferior to the person to whom the promise is made. It is not an exercising authority over another, but over a man's self. No man forceth another to the acceptance of his promise, but only proposeth and encourageth it to an embracing of it. But commanding supposeth always an authority in the person giving the precept. It obligeth the person to whom the command is directed. A promise obligeth the person by whom the promise is made. God, by his command, binds the creature. By his promise, he binds himself. He stops below his sovereignty, stoops below his sovereignty, to lay obligations upon his own majesty. By a precept, he binds the creature. By a promise, he encourageth the creature to an observance of his precept. What law God makes, man is bound, by virtue of his creation, to observe. That respects the sovereignty of God. What promises God makes, man is bound to believe, but that respects the faithfulness of God. God manifested his dominion more to the Jews than to any other people in the world. He was their lawgiver, both as they were a church and a commonwealth. As a church, he gave them ceremonial laws for the regulating their worship. As a state, he gave them judicial laws for the ordering their civil affairs. And as both, he gave them moral laws upon which both the laws of the church and the state were founded. This dominion of God, in this regard, will be manifest, 1, in the supremacy of it. The sole power of making laws doth originally reside in him. James 4:12, there is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. By his own law he judges of the eternal state of men, and no law of man is obligatory, but as it is agreeable to the laws of this supreme lawgiver, and pursuant to his righteous rules for the government of the world. The power that the potentates of the world have to make laws is but derivative from God. If their dominion is from him, as it is, for by him kings reign, Proverbs 8:15, their legislative power, which is a prime flower of their sovereignty, is derived from him also, and the apostle resolves it into this original when he orders us to be subject to the higher powers, not only for wrath, but for conscience sake, Romans 13:5. Conscience, in its operations, solely respects God, and therefore when it is exercised as a principle of obedience to the laws of men, it is not with respect to them, singly considered, but as the majesty of God appears in their station and in their decrees. This power of giving laws was acknowledged by the heathen to be solely in God by way of original. And therefore the greatest lawgivers among the heathen pretended their laws to be received from deity, some deity or supernatural power, by special revelation. Now whether they did this seriously, acknowledged themselves as part of the dominion of God, for it is certain that whatsoever just orders were issued out to princes in the world, was by the secret influence of God upon their spirits. Proverbs 8:15. By me princes decree judges, justice, by the secret conduct of divine wisdom, or whether they pretended it only as a public engine to enforce upon people the observance of their decrees and gain a greater credit to their edicts. Yet this will result from it, that the people, in general, entertained this common notion that God was the great lawgiver of the world. The first founders of their societies could never else have so absolutely gained upon them by such a pretense. There was always a revelation of a law from the mouth of God in every age. The exhortation of Eliphaz to Job, Job 22:22, of receiving a law from the mouth of God at the time before the moral law was published, had been a vain exhortation had there been no revelation of the mind of God in all ages. 2. The dominion of God is manifest in the extent of his laws. As he is the governor and sovereign of the whole world, so he enacts laws for the whole world. One prince cannot make laws for another, unless he makes him his subject by right or conquest. Spain cannot make laws for England, or England for Spain, but God, having the supreme government as king over all, is a lawgiver to all, to irrational as well as rational creatures. The heavens have their ordinances, Job 38:33. All creatures have a law imprinted on their beings. Rational creatures have divine statutes copied in their heart. For men, it is clear, Romans 2:14, every son of Adam, at his coming into the world, brings with him a law in his nature. And when reason clears itself up from the clouds of sense, he can make some difference between good and evil, discern something of fit and just. Every man finds a law within him that checks him if he offends it. None are without a legal indictment and a legal executioner within them. God or none was the author of this as a sovereign lord in establishing a law in man at the same time wherein, as an almighty creator, he imparted a being. This law proceeds from God's general power of governing, as he is the author of nature, and binds not barely as it is the reason of man, but by the authority of God, as it is a law engraven on his conscience. No doubt but a law was given to the angels. God did not govern those intellectual creatures as he doth brutes, and in a way inferior to his rule of man. Some sinned. All might have sinned in regard to the changeableness of their nature. Sin cannot be but against some rule. Where there is no law, there is no transgression. What that law was is not revealed, but certainly it must be the same in part of the moral law, so far as it agreed with their spiritual natures, a love to God, a worship of him, and a love to one another in their societies and persons. 3. The dominion of God is manifest in the reason of some laws which seem to be nothing else than purely his own will. Some laws there are for which a reason may be rendered from the nature of the thing enjoined as to love, honour, and worship God. For others none but this, God will have it so. Such was that positive law to Adam of not eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Genesis 2:17, which was merely an asserting his own dominion and was different from the law of nature God had written in his heart. No other reason of this seems to us but to resolve to try man's obedience in a way of absolute sovereignty and to manifest his right over all creatures, to reserve what he pleased to himself and permit the use of what he pleased to man, and to signify to man that he was to depend on him who was his Lord and not on his own will. There was no more hurt in itself for Adam to have eaten of that than of any other in the garden. The fruit was pleasant to the eye and good for food, but God would show the right he had over his own goods and his authority over man to reserve what he pleases of his own creation from his touch. And since man could not claim a propriety in anything, he was to meddle with nothing but by leave of his sovereign, either discovered by a special or general license. Thus God showed himself the Lord of man, and that man was but his steward to act by his orders. If God had forbidden man the use of more trees in the garden, his command had been just. Just as sovereign Lord, he might dispose of his own goods. And when he had granted him the whole compass of that pleasant garden, and the whole world round about for him and his posterity, it was a more tolerable exercise of his dominion to reserve this one tree as a mark of his sovereignty, when he had left all others to the use of Adam. He reserved nothing to himself as lord of the manor but this, and Adam was prohibited nothing else but this one as a sign of his subjection. Nor for this no reason can be rendered by any man but merely the will of God. This was merely a fruit of his dominion. For the moral laws, a reason may be rendered to love God, hath reason to enforce it, besides God's will, that is, the excellency of his nature, and the greatness and multitude of his benefits. To love our neighbour hath enforcing reasons, that is, the conjunction in blood, the preservation of human society, and the need we may stand in of their love for ourselves. But no reason can be assigned of this positive command about the tree of knowledge of good and evil, but the pleasure of God. It was a branch of his pure dominion but merely the pleasure of God. It was a branch of his pure dominion to try man's obedience, and a mark of his goodness to try it by so light a precept, which he might have extended his authority further. This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalogue, containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, CDs and much more, at great discounts, are on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, AB, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalogue. If you do have a web connection and would like to be added to our email list, please send an email to ad@swrb.com or swrb@swrb.com with the word add in the subject line. SWRB's email list is a double opt-in list, so once you've sent us your email address, you will be asked by email to confirm that you want to join our list using the email address you have supplied. Your email information will be kept confidential. And you can easily remove yourself from our email list by simply emailing us at swrb@swrb.com with the word remove in the subject line. Once you are on our email list, you will be alerted to all the new free Reformation resources, free MP3s, free electronic books and texts, etc. SWRB makes available on the web as well as at times to our best discounts and super specials. We also encourage you to reproduce this audio resource and to pass it on to your friends. But we only authorize this as long as the full content of the message, including the header and trailer, is not altered in any way, and as long as the audio file or cassette is given away for free. Thank you again for listening to this SWRB reading, and remember that Isaiah 26:3 states, "Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee." And 2 Corinthians 13:11 concludes, "Finally, brethren, farewell. Be perfect. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace shall be with you."